Welcome to many of you who have not been here before and are from out of town. We're glad you didn't have too many problems getting here, although I hear south of Fort Worth was worse than it usually is. We do have just this one case on our 10:30 docket. If the clerk will please announce counsel. Thank you. All right, Ms. Youngblood.
Are you related to Edwin?
Pardon?
Are you related to Edwin?
No, I'm not. I get that. I'll ask that often. But to my knowledge, I'm not. It could be. I found out that a lot of people named Youngblood, we are distantly
well, how
are you related.
Not Edwin?
Okay. May it please the court. And hello to each of you again. I am passionately proud of my profession. Therefore, my word is my bond. That's from our mandate for professionalism, section 1.1. Also, section 3.4, I will attempt to prepare documents which correctly reflect the agreement of the parties. I will not include provisions which have not been agreed upon or omit provisions which are necessary to reflect the agreement of the parties. Your Honors, I am frankly bothered by some aspects of this case which reflect poorly on our profession. When I hear that attorneys say, well, I guess we'll call this the Zurich proviso to the Lawyer's Creed 1.1. My word is my bond, unless I give it by email. Then my fingers are crossed, and it doesn't count. When I hear lawyers promote Rule 11 to create an obvious injustice, Rule 11 when there's no pending case, Rule 11 when there's no real dispute about what the Rule 11 when you have something in writing created by the party to be charged, Rule 11 when you there's no really dispute about what the email said, no one said that the opposite party hacked their email system and created an email that was phony, Rule 11 when you have a more formal agreement that the parties contemplate, I'd point you to Rule 1 of our Rules of Civil Procedure. The proper objective of Rules of Procedure is to obtain a just, fair, equitable, impartial adjudication of the rights of litigants. I'm going to compress this to that end. The least expense both to the litigants and to the state as may be practical, these rules shall be given a liberal construction, not a hyper-technical construction, not a strict construction, which is what they want Rule 11 to be applied. When I hear about using our trap 6.6 to negate an agreement of the parties, when there wasn't even an appeal between these parties, no case, again and again and again, there's simply no case law to, or any authority to support what the appellees in this case have promoted. When I hear that, okay, we have a more formal agreement, the email says we will have a more formal agreement, we have a more formal agreement. It took some doing to get there, but that was not the appellant's, Mr. Cunningham's, fault. That was the fault of the appellees, but we got there. But when I hear, oh, no, that's the wrong kind of a more formal agreement. We needed a specific kind of more formal agreement, and we don't have that. But it's confidential, so we can't tell you why what we've got is not what the more formal agreement that we said we would enter into. When I hear parties, the appellees say that a missing essential element, there was an essential element missing, but they will never tell you what that element is. I'm bothered by that. When I hear them talk about something, types of issue preclusion, they call it sometimes res judicata or law of the case. Why? Because this court, when I attempted in the underlying lawsuit that was on appeal, I filed the email with the court, attempted to get it enforced. I was unsuccessful. And what am I going to say about that? I'm going to say, I think that you were right to not enforce that because it wasn't against, didn't involve the parties to the appeal. It involved an agreement with the insurers of the parties. And I can see why that decision was made by this court. But that is not res judicata, and this court, I'm sure, does not want to have the burden to say, okay, if we can't enforce this and dismiss the appeal, then there can't be a lawsuit to enforce the agreement. No, that's not, there's no case law that supports that, but again, you just won't find case law to support appellee's condition. When I hear things about a confidential settlement agreement being discussed with a wink and a nod and say, just trust me, that means that the appellant loses. I'm concerned about that.
Well, let's go to the merits, okay? Let's talk about, was there agreement? If there wasn't an agreement, why wasn't there an agreement? Was there an essential element missing? Was there a condition precedent that was never met? Let's talk about those issues.
I think there was an agreement. It's an offer and acceptance. Offer. It was a demand, just a strong word for an offer. It was accepted. It was repeated in Ms. Grabowski's email. Those were the right terms. We agreed to them. That's done. Nothing that happened after that can revoke it or change it or withdraw it. It's done when the email is sent.
And so who were parties to, according to your position, who were the parties to your email agreement?
It was Mr. Cunningham on the one side and Zurich and JUA on the other side, because those were the only people that were going to do anything. They were going to pay. We knew that the judgment debtors didn't have the money to pay. They were out of it. They wanted this done, naturally. The trial court wanted it done. They were having all these net worth proceedings. And so the only people that agreed to do anything and were asked to be doing anything was Zurich and JUA. Zurich to pay $650,000 and JUA to assign its deposited funds, you know, whatever it turned out to be. So that's the parties to the agreement. As far as the conditions precedent, this is normal in almost every mediation agreement, any agreement read into the record at a trial court, anything like this to say, and we'll do a more formal agreement. I think under these conditions, you should consider that a covenant, not a condition precedent. But if it's a condition precedent, we pled under Rule 54 that it was met, and it was, not as quickly as we would like it to be, or maybe it should have been, but it was met. Zurich never denied a Rule 54 any condition precedent. They never said, well, we don't have a more formal agreement. And they really couldn't have, because we did. JUA did, but they did say under Rule 54, there's no Rule 11 agreement. But they didn't say, but there's no more formal agreement. And we say that, okay, the Rule 11 agreement can't be considered a deal breaker for two reasons. One, consider why you don't have one. We signed one, the appellant signed one that was consistent with the email, consistent with the agreement of the parties. Nobody else signed one, so to say we don't have one, that's sort of like the criminal defendant who throws himself on the mercy of the court. He'd been charged with killing his parents on the grounds that he's an orphan. Well, why don't you have one? Why isn't there an agreement? Because we don't have a Rule 11. Why isn't there a Rule 11? Because we don't have an agreement. Well, it just goes round and round and round. But the point is, I don't see any case that would so focus on a strict adherence, hyper-technical construction of Rule 11 to say that when you've got a more formal agreement that we're going to say you still don't have a deal because you didn't do the Rule 11 as an on the way to getting the more formal agreement.
But Ms. Youngblood, under Rule 11 itself, a more formal agreement requires a signing of the agreement by the parties to be charged. And I don't see or know of any case that has held that you don't need to have that formality under any circumstances in order for it to be enforced.
Well, there's...
You could have more than one document under Padilla versus France. You'd have a series of letters. You could have a series of emails and letters. But at some point, in order to enforce it, I think since Kennedy versus Hyde, you have to have a signed agreement.
I would say that's what Rule 11 says, if Rule 11 applies when you don't even have a pending case. But assuming Rule 11 applies, then it can be excused. And if you don't, of course, we have the equivalent of the Rule 11 in the email. It's a document. It's in writing. I don't know of any case that says Rule 11 can't be satisfied by an email. When I say a Rule 11 letter agreement, I'm just using the phraseology that they used in the email. We will have a Rule 11 letter agreement. I'm not necessarily agreeing that it is bound by Rule 11. I just call it a letter agreement, but we can call it a Rule 11. And when the only party that that would not enter into that, when one party will not enter into a letter agreement, then they have excused the existence of a letter agreement. In the case of Henry versus City of Fort Worth, which was just decided last week by this court, they addressed the same issue, that you don't have a document signed by all the parties. Nevertheless, you have something in writing, and you know what it was, and they don't deny it, and that it mentions having additional documents, a formal agreement. The other one party won't do that. Under those circumstances, a liberal construction of Rule 11 shows that its intended purposes are met. And so they're not going to hang their hat on the fact that one party didn't sign it when there's no reason why they shouldn't have signed it. I think here we have a flawed settlement strategy at work, that there were attorneys negotiating in good faith over this on all parts, I will say, certainly on my behalf, for Mr. Kevin Carey, on behalf of his client, JUA and Dr. Izukama, and Ms. Grabowski, on behalf of Zurich. I think it was fairly negotiated. But now it seems clear that others, not in part of those negotiations, thought that a better deal could have and should have been had and could be had if they just tried to change the terms. And that's what's driving this. The fact that the idea that an email doesn't count, we file pleadings, we file our taxes electronically. And what Zurich is trying to do here is, I think, just vindicate their Rule 11 gambit. They're willing to go to any lengths and apparently any amount of money to get a ruling that an email cannot satisfy Rule 11. As far as the confidential settlement, I think more has been said about that already than should have been said. But I encourage you to look. If you have any questions, the best place in the record to look to find out about that is the agreed motion for partial non-suit. Partial, why is it partial? Because it clearly says this breach of contract claim can go forward. So nothing in that confidential agreement should give you any pause as to whether or not this suit, this claim for breach of contract has been any way impaired. There were no affirmative defenses pled about that, and there really could not have been based on the true facts. So that's a red herring, and I don't think anything that this court should give focus and undue attention to. There are no questions from the court at this time, then I will terminate my remarks.
Thank you, Ms. Youngblood. Is it Locano?
Yes,
did I say it correctly? Joe Locano. And you're arguing first, and then Mr. Osler?
Van Osler.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Joe Loyacano. Together with John Wilson, we represent Texas Medical Liability Insurance Underwriting Association. It's commonly referred to as the Joint Underwriting Association, or JUA. Prior to today's proceedings, I conferred with Mr. Van Osler about who would go first, and what we decided to do is this. I'm going to take on that threshold issue that Justice Gardner actually brought up, and that primarily deals with, aside from whether there's a contract or not, does Rule 11 and perhaps Rule 6.6 require this purported agreement to be in writing? Mr. Van Osler then will take up the task of addressing whether there was ever really a contract created between Zurich and Mr. Cunningham. On the Rule 11 issue, I would like just to echo Justice Gardner's point regarding Kennedy versus Hyde. And in that particular case, the Texas Supreme Court case spoke to the issue about we don't want to restrict an attorney's or attorney's ability to negotiate settlements. However, we don't want to trap them either. And for that reason, Kennedy versus Hyde required that settlement negotiations be reduced to writing, or alternatively, that they be presented in open court. Ms. Youngblood made reference to this court's decision last week in Henry, and I believe, Justice Livingston, you authored that, and that case is readily distinguishable from this particular case, because as you will recall in that case, what happened was there was an unsigned agreement. However, that agreement was presented in open court with the parties being present and all assenting to the agreement. What I think is really more on point in this particular situation is three of this court's opinions that were handed back in 2001, two of which were authored by Justice D'Auphineau. And those opinions are the Alcantar versus Oklahoma National Bank, 47 SW3D 815, and the Rendon versus Avance, 67 SW3D 303. Those are two of the cases, or two of the opinions, I believe, that were authored by you, which spoke to the requirement that settlement negotiations be reduced to writing. If they are not reduced to writing or presented in open court, they are unenforceable. And that's exactly what we have here. The third Fort Worth Court of Appeals case that came out in 2001 that I think is also provide some insight into the situation in this case is the Prevost, P-R-E-V-O-S-T, versus Insurance Advisors, 46 SW3D 289. Speaking now to Rule 11 more directly, first of all, I want to make clear that with regard to this email, that email was not authored by JUA or by attorneys retained by JUA or even by attorneys retained by JUA to represent JUA's insureds. We are not part authorship. We have no authorship whatsoever in that agreement. That being said, let me address some of these concerns that were brought up with regard to whether there were any pending suits to which Rule 11 would have applied. The answer to that is yes. There were actually three pending suits, and prior to the proceedings this morning, I asked the clerk to provide you with a copy of the proposed Rule 11 agreement that was circulated. This proposed Rule 11 agreement was circulated after this email was generated by Ms. Grabowski in an effort to come up with a more formal agreement. You'll notice that on the caption of the agreement, it states three different cases. The first case is the malpractice case, the underlying malpractice case involving Zurich and JUA's insured physicians, and that case was up on appeal. The second case is Cunningham versus Worth Bank. It's the garnishment proceeding. JUA is actually a party in that second proceeding that was pending at the district court level in Tarrant County. Why? Because Mr. Cunningham was trying to get judgment recovery from JUA. He was suing JUA directly to try to get the amount that was recovered in judgment in the malpractice suit. The third case that's referenced is Cunningham versus Zurich. That was a case that was pending over in Dallas County. Once again, that was a case whereby Mr. Cunningham was attempting to sue Zurich directly to recover on the underlying judgment. Therefore, what we have are three pending cases which were, quote, touched, close quote, by a proposed Rule 11 agreement. And therefore, certainly Rule 11 would apply. Now, I understand, and let me back up and just say one last thing about this particular point. This document that was provided to you was marked up by Ms. Youngblood, and it was marked up because she contended that there was a party involved in the release that should not have been involved. However, she stated in her deposition, and this is Clerk's Record 719, with the exception of the inclusion of Dr. Haruna in this proposed Rule 11 agreement, all other terms were accurate. Therefore, she has conceded in her own deposition that this proposed Rule 11 agreement was to touch three different suits. Let me try to tackle, by the way, one last point about the email. It's not only this proposed Rule 11 agreement that addresses multiple proceedings, but rather it's the email itself that was authored by Ms. Grabowski. You'll notice that in the email, and there's a handout for you that might be a little bit more easy to read, she states not once, but twice, that the release was to cover proceedings, that, more specifically, a complete release of the parties and a dismissal of all proceedings were contemplated by the negotiations. Now, I understand, and let me just close on this one point, I understand that there may be an issue as to whether Rule 11 would extend to a suit that was on appeal. And I can tell you that I do not know of a case that specifically allows for that. With that being said, it's clear that as between these parties involved in before you today, there were indeed two district court proceedings pending to which Rule 11 would attach. Furthermore, if we wanted to join in the malpractice case, well, certainly Rule 6.6 would apply to that case pending on appeal. Conditions preceding on that issue were pled by JUA in detail prior to and timely in connection with its motion for summary judgment. You can find an extensive statement regarding the conditions preceding actually in our amended answer, which is at Clerk's Record 789 and 790. Furthermore, all parties, Zurich as well as JUA, specifically addressed Rule 6.6 in their motion for summary judgment, specifically denying the execution of a contract, which is what would be required under both Rule 6.6 and Rule 11. With that being said, if the court does not have any questions for me, I will return my time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Van Osler.
May it please the court. My name is Paul Van Osler. I am counsel for Zurich. I'm also proud to be the law partner of Laura Grabowski, the author of the email. As we look at this case, there are really two simple issues. There is the Rule 11 issue addressed by Mr. Loiacano, but there's also a more fundamental issue of basic contract law, and that's what I'm going to focus on, along with briefly an issue relating to public policy and the way settlements are being conducted by lawyers in the state of Texas, probably as I am speaking here now. Now, Ms. Youngblood is correct that an oral demand, we use those words as lawyers, is an offer in contract terms, and there is no doubt that there was a demand, an offer, orally made by Ms. Youngblood. There's a lot of testimony about that in the trial court as part of the record. But the response does not create a contract. Basic contract law is that if an offer is made, it can, of course, be accepted. But if the terms of an acceptance impose conditions on it, change the terms, it is, under contract law, a rejection of that offer and a new counteroffer. That is first-year contract law, as I recall it, although many years ago. Under those circumstances, that is exactly what the email is. It is, under its exact language, we will pay $650,000, but there are conditions imposed on that. There were three conditions. If you read through, it's and further conditioned upon, and if you sort through all of that, there are three. It is that JUA fund its money that was in the registry of the court. it was that there be a satisfactory Rule 11 agreement signed by all counsel. Now, in the briefing, we've heard, and it's interesting, in the briefing, they say, well, that just meant the counsel involved in this agreement, not the counsel in the case. That doesn't make any sense because you're settling a lawsuit, and as Mr. Loyakana pointed out, there was a case in which certainly JUA was already a party. And it's interesting that it can't be all counsel, as they are suggesting, just outside of the trial, because Mr. Loyakana never signed it, as he has already pointed out. To some extent, JUA and Zurich are joined at the hip, and so there was thus no agreement. Now, let me address this issue of the conditions precedent. It's a relatively new issue. I would say that the Court of Appeals in San Antonio in the S.M. Wilson case had it right, that the issue of conditions precedent, that you, if you plead they've been satisfied, that that's all you have to do unless it's specifically denied, does not go to the issue of the creation of the contract in the first place. That was the holding of the S.M. Wilson case, and I think it is good law. But more importantly, on the facts of this case, if Rule 54 did apply, all it would mean is that the plaintiff, appellant here, would be excused from the opportunity to put on some evidence on that topic. It is interesting that on that topic they did introduce evidence, on the topic of the conditions, choosing not to hide behind, shouldn't use the word hide, not to rely on Rule 54. They put on affirmative evidence, and it's in our brief with respect to, and particularly I would call your attention to page 14 of our original brief, the evidence they put on. They put on evidence that one of the counsel, Mr. Kevin Carey for Dr. Haruna, wrote a letter that says, it appears to me there's no agreement, I'm not signing anything. There's also evidence that obviously, by the very nature that this lawsuit was filed against JUA, plaintiffs were putting on evidence that JUA had not agreed. And then finally, I would say that the summary judgment motion, which we introduced, when we filed for summary judgment, we specifically raised the issue that these conditions were not met. If you read Rule 54, it just says we have to deny it. It was denied in the summary judgment motion, if nothing else. And when it came to the hearing on that, the so-called trial, effectively, that there was no objection at all at the time, objecting to our summary judgment as being beyond the pleadings and raising issues not on it. That was just not an issue at the time. I think the right answer is, of course, the S.M. Wilson case, but we certainly have met those kind of obligations. We've also recently heard that the case ultimately did settle, and that is a fact, some 8-9 months later. And the issue is, we now know from one of these, I believe it's the reply brief, as raised by the appellants, that because it ultimately did settle, it now proves that there was an agreement. I would respectfully suggest to this court that that goes on every day. There are settlements that are attempted, you think you got a deal, and at the last minute something falls apart. Something can't happen, somebody doesn't do anything, a condition's not met, cases go on, and ultimately it is created, and then there's ultimately going to be a settlement. I would also tell you that there's evidence in the record, again, going back to basic contract law, that while there was this counteroffer with all these conditions out there, when it wasn't accepted, Ms. Grabowski revoked the offer. And, of course, a revocation of an offer prior to its acceptance means that it's simply not there. Let me also address briefly the issue of, I call it the $650,000 issue. And that is the claim that in the unlikely, we believe, event that the appellants are successful, that they're entitled to a remand, not just a remand, but a rendering that they get $650,000. It was successfully pled via affidavit that there was a satisfaction of the judgment. And I would call the court's attention to the court's order dismissing the underlying case that said that it would be a credit in the case. They would not be entitled to that $650,000. Obviously, that's not their theory, because note they're not asking that JUA repay its additional money. I think that's a red herring. Finally, let me address public policy. One of my favorite law professors, John Sutton, told me one time that he was puzzled by all the emphasis on Rule 11. And that as a result of that, you know, what's going on? And why are Rule 11 agreements getting so detailed? And the answer is that lawyers are putting more and more into Rule 11 because you really do have lawyers saying, I'm sorry, that's not going to be part of our agreement because you didn't put it in the Rule 11 agreement. It's sort of causing a backup. You have to get very specific in these longer and longer Rule 11 agreements. What this appellant is asking this court to do is back it up even further and to change the language every time you draft something that says, you know, I'm going to release the defendant. Oh, I'm sorry, you didn't include officers, directors, Dr. Haruna, members. You didn't include that in the original agreement. That's the signed agreement. It goes back to Rule 11, and this is an attempt to move that back even further. As I said a moment ago, I believe as I am speaking here today, there are lawyers writing emails saying, you know, I'll pay X if so-and-so pays Y, and then we kind of get together on a Rule 11 agreement. That is happening now. This, a ruling as requested, a holding as requested by the appellant, I would suggest would violate public policy interest in promoting discussions on settlement and moving back even farther the issues of resolution of cases. And with that, I will conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Osler. Ms. Youngblood, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To reply to Mr. Locano's, JUA's, arguments about the three cases that were in the, what we're calling the Rule 11 letter agreement, none of those cases were mentioned, of course, in the email. But those cases, I'll point out, it says you should file the document in those cases. Of course, well, I did. Of course I did. Filed it attached as a motion for summary judgment in the one court, the Dallas court, filed it with this court. The garnishment case, there's nothing in the record about whether it was filed in that case or not. I frankly don't remember, but I can tell you that that case had been stayed. A JUA had been dismissed. I can't remember at what point, but the stay was what Judge Wade did as part of his supersedious proceedings. So that was a stayed case, and I don't know if you can consider a stayed case a pending case, and I don't remember if I filed it there or not, but I filed it in just about every other court in this state, or so it seems. So I don't see how they can hang their hat on, but you've got to file it. Well, we did. They said that Mr. Locano said the Dallas court case was pending at that time as an attempt to collect the judgment against the insurers, and that's true, but that was, it was satisfied. Any requirement to file this document or any document in that court, it was done. And of course, that case was transferred to the Tarrant County case. Judge Wade's court got it back. So that's the same proceeding, Dallas court and then the court from which this appeal was taken. So it's been filed multiple times. I don't see how you can say you didn't comply with Rule 11 in that respect. Mr. Van Osler says three conditions in the email. There's no evidence that there was anything in the email that was inconsistent with the oral agreements, the demand that had been made, and the affidavit that I filed in the trial court below says that they're the same. There's no inconsistencies. There's no new matters. It's not a counteroffer. It was an acceptance. But he says, well, three things. One, JUA must fund its money. Done. Number two, must be a satisfactory Rule 11 agreement by all counsel. Satisfactory under the Hackenberry case, citing in our brief, says satisfactory is you consider that from an objective point of view, not what subjectively one party says, well, I'm not satisfied with that. A satisfactory Rule 11 was signed by us, and the other side refused to sign a satisfactory Rule 11, so it's excused. I don't think Mr. Van Osler said the third one, but I assume it means the more formal agreement. And okay, we're back here. If we can't say we've got a more formal agreement in this case, why not? Why not? We've got one. So the conditions, if there were that, they're satisfied. Rule 54, yes, we pled it in our motion for summary judgment and our response to their summary judgment motions. We said Rule 54, we pled it, that all conditions were met or satisfied, excused, or waived, and the other side has not. So, yes, we raised that in the trial court level. Mr. Van Osler says the Wilson case got it right, the San Antonio court. Well, I don't think they did, and the Supreme Court says they didn't get it right. Not directly, because that case didn't go up on to the Supreme Court, but the Hohenberg case, I can't remember the two others, one PAJ, that was the dissent, but they were reviewing the law that says contract formation is a condition precedent. So that's... I want to talk just a moment about attorney's fees and the relief sought. The attorney's fees that we pled and proved up are very high, but if you look at the detailed billing statement that I did, you can see why. Multiple weeks that had to make trips from Houston to Dallas twice a week. Monday I go, Tuesday I come back, Wednesday I go, Thursday I come back, and on and on and on. And you can see why this case was lit. I see my time is up, but if I may just conclude
just
this thought.
Just finish your sentence, yeah.
You can see why this case was fought very vigorously, why the attorney's fees got up to the point they did. And as far as the relief, we are asking it be reversed and rendered. And the only thing I could see looking over things last night why that would be a problem is the amount of relief that was sought against JUA, because they have come up with their payment. So the only thing that we would seek from them is, in addition to the attorney's fees, which we say both joint and several, is the amount of money that from the time they did pay, they should have paid, until they did pay the lost interest. And just for simplicity, I would say I think you can make that June 1st, the time they should have paid, October 1st, the time they did pay. That's not really accurate, it's not precise, but for the purposes of trying to simplify and getting the court to a point where they can reverse and render as opposed to remand over something fairly trivial, I think that would be more than acceptable to the appellants. If there are no questions, I will conclude my remarks.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Youngblood. We appreciate your arguments. Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments as well and all the briefing. Your case is now submitted. You all are excused, and court will be adjourned.
All right.